You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Ow! The Wounded. I'm Sean from Timmins.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Sorry about that, Sean. I didn't mean to poke you that hard.
Pain sticks. I hate them.
I know. Well, Brian loves them. Brian Dedamore?
Yeah, the Klingon guy?
Oh, he loves pain sticks. Friday night, you could find Brian and just... Well, anyway. Sean, how have you been? We haven't had you on for a while. I was just going to take a look, but...
Legacy,
wow. How have you been since Legacy?
Fantastic, actually. What can I say? I've sorted out all my personal life issues ever since I lost my Rusted Robot co-host a year ago.
Yeah.
I started seeing a new lady, and she's fantastic. Yeah, everything's wonderful.
See, now, if I lost my Battle Bridge co-host, I don't know if I'd want to start seeing a new doctor.
Well,
oh, that's so sweet, Lou.
Yeah.
But I've really got a replacement for you lined up.
Oh, really? Who?
I think I've promised it to Colin, I'm pretty sure.
Hey, I already promised it to Colin. Colin backed out at the last minute, so it's his loss.
It seems like there's a threesome going on here.
Really? Okay. Well, the only thing you're missing, Sean, is the English accent.
Ugh, I got a Scottish one.
Do you?
No, I can't do accents.
Me either. I could try, but I'm usually terrible at it.
Me too.
So tell us about where the rusted robot is. Have you gotten any oil yet, or is it still very rusted?
Well, you know what? It's gone through some transformations ever since Bridget left. I've had to retool it, and I do it with a bunch of D&D guys. And I don't know. It's different, but it's pretty good. James, you've been binging it. How do you find the new format?
Yes, I mean, as we discussed just before you came on, Sean, or at least before we started recording, I have been binging it because I had fallen behind. And it's really... I'm sure everyone, this happens to everyone when you've got kind of like these long running podcasts, especially when they're being produced regularly. Every now and again, you would be on a holiday or something and you start building a backlog. So I have over the past couple of days gone on I think it was six or so back to back of Rusted Robot. And we are indeed in the post Bridget world. I always used to describe the Rusted Robot to begin with as kind of, you know, a bunch of kind of, it was always a couple dynamic, yeah. And also a very much a Canadian, happy Canadian dynamic as well.
Yes.
And that's kind of still there, but it's been transplanted into the, well, I always imagined you guys just sat around a gaming board in the comic book shop. That's what I imagine is going on. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it's very much a kind of like a chat over a game.
Kind of. We usually play a game and then we record an episode of the podcast at Josh's house.
Okay, sure.
Hmm.
But close enough.
Hmm. Okay.
So it's still going strong.
Well, that's good. And is Rusted Robot the only one you're doing so far?
No, I'm also doing Sci-Fi Waffle with James's countryman, Paul Wright.
Hmm. Furbob.
Yes. Captain Furbob, Admiral Furbob, whatever he goes by these days.
Oh, yeah. Giving himself a promotion, is he?
Sometimes he does that.
Hmm. Okay. So he's also in the triangle of Englishmen that we love so much.
Exactly.
And okay, so you wanted to mention some brief things. By the time people hear this, we would have already been back from Las Vegas, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. But at this time, as we record this, it's 4 days after the release of Star Trek Beyond, and we have committed ourselves not to watch it until we meet up with each other in Las Vegas. But you wanted to kind of briefly touch on it without giving plot spoilers. What are your thoughts of it so far?
Well, I saw it on the 23rd. I liked it a lot. It, of course, it has its flaws. You know, everything does. But definitely go see it in the theater. It's a worthy addition. It's way better than Into Darkness. Some pretty cool scenes. And I'm in love with Jayla. And just lots of fun. It's really good.
And I don't even know what a Jayla is. But I guess I'll find out.
Well, you've seen the trailer, right?
No. Well, yes.
The girl with the white makeup and the black lines on her face.
Oh, okay.
With the cute squeaky voice.
I don't remember that.
Well, she stole the show anyway.
Did she?
Okay. So let me ask you a question, Sean. I've seen the trailers, and the trailers very much remind me of the Voyager episode, The Swarm. In particular, when they have all the small vessels, or it looks like small vessels, kind of like attacking the ship.
Yeah.
Is it as awesome as The Swarm?
I don't remember The Swarm, but it's even better than that.
Don't worry. The Swarm was a pretty bad episode of Voyager. It was forgettable.
Okay.
But anyway, hey, if it's better than The Swarm, then looking forward to it.
Yep. I gave it a 7 out of 10. It's probably worth like an 8, but... Yeah, it had its moments. We talked about it on the last episode of The Rusted Robot. I liked it way more than anybody else. But, yeah, it's awesome.
Well, 8 out of 10, that would probably put it at a 4 out of 5, so, obviously. Hey, there's that Catholic school math going on there.
There you go. And the other piece of news, of course, is that the new Star Trek series is called Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, yes, I saw this. This was announced last week.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it sounds interesting. I did see the little teaser they had for it, including the ship. You like the ship?
No!
Oh, no. I don't think the ship's that super.
It's horrible.
Apparently there was a bit of a backlash against the ship, and then since then Brian Fuller's come out and said, well, it's not really finished, and we're still at the very early stages of, you know, reckoning what we should be doing here. So I don't know if he was surprised about how much of a backlash there was. They've tried to plug that one.
Yes.
And also, okay. Here's an issue that I have, and I will ask you guys. So the Discovery itself is supposed to be set around the undiscovered country kind of time frame. That's my understanding. Between when we leave Kirk's crew and Next Gen.
That's true.
Do we not know if that's true anymore?
No. There's so many rumors going around that nobody knows.
Okay. Because I have a problem. If it is there, I have a problem with the registry being 1031.
Right, because the Enterprise is 1701, and this is Ford,
I know that this makes me kind of probably diagnosable on the clinical scale, but it can't be 1031 and be there. I mean, 2031, well, everything's fine. I'll accept it, but 1031 suggests it's pre-Enterprise.
Yes. Unless it is pre-Enterprise, and then it was in mothballs, and some rogue crew had to pull it out, or it's been on a deep space mission for hundreds of years.
I would accept any of those explanations, as long as you don't badge a new ship earlier than the, well, I suppose the NX-2000, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you're talking about the film series.
Exactly. So we'll have to see what's going to happen. It's going to be interesting, I'm sure.
Yep. Anywho.
Okay.
There we go. Sorry, Lou.
No, well, that's all right. And then last week, James told me that he got an email that we could go see Star Trek Beyond immersed in better than 3D, only to find out that it's only the closest available was in Los Angeles. So that ain't going to happen. So
yeah, it's apparently a special showing of the film where instead of it being kind of, you know, ultra widescreen 3D thing, they actually have what it sounded like, you know, 8 or 9 separate cinema screens in front of you.
Ooh.
And it, I mean, it just seemed a bit weird. And logistically, I'd pretty like to see what a cinema looks like when it's in that kind of a, you know, super. It's like taking IMAX to the extreme. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, laying the smack down on IMAX and saying, hey, this is how you really do it.
Well, the film does lend itself to that kind of viewing. It is pretty expansive.
Mm. Okay. Well, it's too bad we don't get to see that.
Yeah, I was hoping we could talk about it instead of The Wounded, but here we are.
Oh, no. Not yet.
Hey, one second, Sean. If The Wounded doesn't get more than 7 out of 10, then we're going to have serious issues, I think.
I think so, too.
Obviously.
Lou, I do apologize for this in advance, but should we mention that, given that we're on the TrekMate Family Network, that the TrekMate main show is back up and running after a hiatus of around 18 months?
Is it really?
So if you guys have either forgotten to, so if you've killed your subscription in your phone or however you download the download your podcasts, just be aware that that has come back online with Wayne and a new crew.
And what's it called?
Sorry, this is the main TrekMate show.
Right. What's the name of it?
TrekMate.
TrekMate.
Just TrekMate. Okay.
Yeah.
Here I'll.
Because you, sorry, Sean, you came into the network via 10 Forward originally, right?
Yes.
Ah, that's why. So before 10 Forward came online, maybe about a year or so before, the guys in the UK here, they launched TrekMate itself, which at the time was Wayne Emery and Paul Drinkwater basically chatting about Trek over beer, if I'm being kind.
Yeah.
And then obviously we've had various changes and various bits and pieces since then, but after being on a hiatus for quite a while, they kind of came back roaring last week.
Oh, nice. Well, another podcast that I'll have to add to my queue that I'll get behind on.
Well, there you go. Got the link in there for you.
So have faith that previously in the Alpha Quadrant might be coming back.
Okay.
It's possible. Or we'll get around to it after we do DS9 and then Voyager and Enterprise.
The original series?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. We're going to do DS9 next, and then, of course, Voyager and Enterprise, and then we'll go on to the original series. I'm committing, Doc, to the next 10 years of podcasting.
That's going to be more than 10 years.
And then after that, there was this one in the 80s called The Next Generation, which is pretty good.
Oh, yeah, you'll have to want to do that over again, too, after you do Discovery.
Yeah, there you go. After you do Discovery. Yeah, there you go. Or we'll just drop everything and do Discovery. We'll be the first one to bring it out.
There you go.
Well, I just gave somebody an idea. Okay, well then, when you're ready to read, Sean, go for it.
I'm always ready to read, Lou.
All right.
This is the 12th episode of Season 4 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is January 28, 1991. It was written by Stewart and Sarah Charno, Cy Chermak, and teleplay by Jerry Taylor, and directed by Chip Chalmers. That's a pretty cool name.
Yeah.
The guest stars include Bob Gunton as Captain Benjamin Maxwell, Rosalind Chow as Keiko O'Brien, Mark Lamo as Gal Massette, Time Winters? Is that Time Winters? Okay, that's a different name, isn't it? As Glenn Darrow, Marco Rodriguez as Glenn Tell, John Hancock as Admiral Hayden, Colmeany as O'Brien, Major Brett as the voice of the computer. And what do we think of this episode? I thought it was fantastic. What do you guys think?
Doc?
Yes, I will go. This is great. I love this episode. This is wonderful. I was actually trying to think because I think I've been more down on season 4 than many so far. I think I've been kind of pulling the averages down. But I always have very fond memories of season 4, and I think it's clearly episodes like this that kind of hit very, very big highs. there's not a huge amount going on. It's not that big a show, but all of the performances, all of the interactions, everything that is kind of encapsulated as the story, I just don't know what more you'd want. And I think in terms of, you know, I think we move into Next Generation being really kind of exceptionally well executed this season. When you have the average episodes, there's a certain amount of delivery behind it that elevates it. Whereas when you have the good episodes, the well-written episodes, the extra, you know, the extra, the production in terms of, well, I'm not just talking about in terms of what is actually happening in the show, but in terms of the actors, in terms of the writing, in terms of the direction, in terms of the story that's being told, it's all firing on all cylinders. And I think that's really what elevates this episode. It's just something absolutely great. Whereas on paper, you can describe it in two or three lines and you think, well, you know, interesting concept, we'll see how it goes. But how it's delivered on the screen is just wonderful. And what about you, Lou?
Terrible.
It's not terrible. Let me
Horrible. Ugh. Ah, Keiko. Ah, Keiko. Ah, Keiko. That was what O'Brien did in the middle of the night after the previous episode. No, I'm kidding. No, you're right. This is one of the great ones. This is one of my guilty pleasures. This one goes with me everywhere I go on any road trip. Even though, like I said, there's a good chance that Keiko might be pregnant in this one.
That's because cow buds are an aphrodisiac.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was some of that food that she just was grinning and burn that Miles made. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jack. What were you saying?
I was just saying that she gives birth in disaster. Disaster's too far away. They didn't conceive in this episode.
Oh, maybe.
And anyway, as a happily married couple, they no doubt will have many opportunities in the weeks and months to come.
Yes. Well, maybe it was the opposite of Naomi Wildman. You know, quicker than it should have been instead of longer than it should have been. But anyway, yes, I do love this episode, absolutely. So no guess at where my rating's at, but we'll save the obvious for the end. So, guys, tell me, is this the first time we've ever heard of the Cardassians?
I don't know if it's the first time we've heard of them, but it's the first time we've seen them.
Yeah, and it is the first time we do hear of them.
It is, eh?
Yeah, and it is. Okay, it might be. You might mention it is a nitpick because they say, oh, we've got a long struggle with the Cardassians, and you've never heard of these guys before, but you're supposed to have had history. Yeah, you could nitpick. Doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
That doesn't take anything away from the story. It's all good.
Yeah, no, that's not the point. But I'm just wondering, were they brought in to replace the failed Ferengi?
Yeah.
Or do you think maybe they were, you know, planning ahead for DS9 and setting up the baddies for them?
Probably that too, a little bit of both. I think we have to talk about the design of the spoonheads here.
Spoon? That's racist.
I know, because they're brown. They're not blue-gray. And they got a weird headgear thing that we never see again, and facial hair. What's up with that?
Mm. Is it ever? Can Kardashians grow beards? I mean, not like these guys, but later. Can they ever grow beards?
We never see it again.
Never see a beard on one again.
Yeah, I think you might be right there. I have to say that the thing that takes me most out of the episode, and this is, you know, again, unfortunately, the thing that makes me almost diagnosable, is the fact that I sit here and I think, how do these Kardashians fit into what later becomes of Kardashians? And, you know, what can I try to explain in my head to make sure that it's okay?
It's a subspecies.
I'm okay. Well, actually, I don't think you have to go that far. I think you can say, you know, yeah, he might have had a bit of facial hair. I think that might be okay. They're a slightly different color. You think, well, you know, they might just be more tanned versions of the Kardashians. But then I see the helmet and I think, oh, dear. The helmet is the thing that takes me out of the episode almost. It's the one thing that is, in my mind, the break on continuity on the Kardashians is the uh, his little silly helmet, which I don't understand why you'd wear it. It seems to serve no purpose.
Well, I wonder if the writers regretted having the Ferengi head skirt.
No, the head skirt's fantastic, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I think no, there's the Ferengi headgear, and it's not even that, you know, when you meet like soldier Ferengi, they have it. But even the fact that like Rom wears one, I think is wonderful. And I think you've even had occasions where they go to their quarters and they take it off in the same way that you might take off your shoes or take off a coat or a jumper. I think that the head skirt is wonderful on the Ferengi.
It is. It just finishes them off.
Yeah,
it does.
Right.
It does.
I guess what's curious about is, what's the point of it? Why do some wear it and some don't? I guess that's the same as why do some people wear hats here and some don't?
Fashion.
I think it's only... hang on. Am I going to be crazy and say that Quark doesn't wear a head skirt, right?
Nope.
Because I seem to... You know, at the back of my mind, I'm thinking that it's mainly Quark that doesn't wear the head skirt, but almost everyone else does.
Yeah. And if I even remember correctly, I think Nog, after he joins a Federation... He gets a Starfleet colored
one. Yeah, it's red. Yeah.
So I'm sure the Federation doesn't exactly like the head skirt. I mean, they didn't like the Bajoran earring.
Yeah, and you say that, and Riker has a problem with Ro's earring, and he gets a head skirt.
Yeah, he just had a problem with Ro.
I think so.
Definitely. Yes. But they're all good with Wesley. I mean, you know, Wesley killed off someone. But anyway, Nicholas Locarno versus Tom Paris. That's a debate for later.
Yeah, so anyway, for the Cardassian headgear, it was their first time on the show, and they probably didn't know how to do it. Because look at their uniforms. They're all brown instead of the plastic gray, black.
They're obviously a slightly slimmer version of Morn, right? They're like slightly bubbly and packed and, you know, padded.
Yeah. Yeah,
it is a bit of a weird scene. Weird look.
Yeah, but it's their first time, so it's okay. And they're also called Glins and not Glens instead of Glins this time.
Actually, sorry, we're jumping around a lot here, Lou.
You're right.
But there's a point where, you know, obviously Glenn is a name as well.
Yeah.
You can have people called Glenn. And when I saw the episode, you know, often stuff is not explained in Star Trek, right? You'll hear things like, you know, my name is Gul Dukat, and you'll go, well, is Gull his first name? Is that the title? And then when he introduced two people, this is about, is it Glenn Darrow and Glenn Teller or something like that? I'm just thinking, what are the chances that that's actually their name? They happen to have the same first name.
Right.
So this is, you know, William Riker, and this is, you know, William Smith. So is William a type of title?
Maybe Cardassians are forced to name their children Glenn until they deserve a goal. I don't know. Okay. So, let's see. I got in my notes. What now?
I was just going to say, trust is earned and not given away.
Right. Yes. And we will be watching. So I have in my notes, I'm kind of confused. Who is better than who? The Stargazer was running at warp speed ahead of a Cardassian. Okay, so the Stargazer. Captain Picard's former ship, the Stargazer, which we saw in previous episodes, was running at warp speed ahead of a Cardassian warship. So, obviously, Picard tucked tail and ran, which means that the Stargazer wasn't as advanced as a Cardassian warship. But yet, now we're on the Enterprise, and obviously the Cardassian ship wouldn't stand a chance in such a contest.
Our technology has advanced?
It has advanced, but yet, in DS9, it seems like they really came forward in technology and pretty much were just as good as us, if not...
Yeah. It's like leapfrogging.
Leapfrogging. So... You know, one thing, way ahead, let's go way ahead and let's talk about the high-energy sensor system that the Cardassians have.
What? How can we be there?
We're not there. We always do that stuff.
What about that?
But I was wondering, why couldn't... I mean, ships like Voyager could have used one of those.
Yes, they could have.
Well, and only in the sense that maybe, you know, you could probably install it, but it would probably take up a lot of power. And
it's bulky,
only,
too.
You know, yeah. You'd only be interested in using it if you had something to hide. So... Okay. You know, I'm sure most starships can be fitted with stuff in the same way that most cars can be fitted with bulletproof glass. Mm. But, you know, you don't necessarily fit it as standard.
Right. Okay. All right. But basically, we pretty much we're doing a mapping survey near the Cardassian sector because, you know, obviously last time I was in this sector, well, I was running with my tail between my legs. But we go to the newlywed couple.
Oh, boy.
And, no, I gotta tell you, like I said earlier, I thought she was very cute in these last two episodes. But she's obviously never made food for Miles. They seem perplexed by what each other has grown up with. And it's almost like they just got married first and yeah. Then started to get to know each other.
That's how it works in the future.
Is that it?
Oh. I don't see how they would ever be together in the first place. They don't even seem like they have any chemistry.
Oh, definitely not later, they don't.
Hang on. So, I mean, I know I haven't had an opportunity yet to put across all of my feelings about Keiko and O'Brien, but that together, because O'Brien is punching well out of his league here, and the fact that he has to put up with being fed a bit of, you know, fish food in the morning is, frankly, you know, the fact that he even has the audacity to mention this to her just shows you how quickly a guy can turn after he's had a bit of nookie. So I'm fully on Keiko's side here.
Oh, you are, huh?
Yeah, you probably like plankton loaf too.
And sea berries. And mutton shanks. I don't even know what a mutton shank is. I know a mutt's usually a dog.
It's a lamb chop.
It's a lamb chop, yeah.
Oh, is it? What's a shank?
A piece.
Well, that's the leg, right?
That's the leg?
Yeah, it's just to cut off the meat.
Oh, I thought it was a derived knife they use in prisons.
That's a shiv.
Oh, that's a shank. You don't know your shits from your shanks.
I do know that Captain Benjamin Maxwell is the warden from Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right.
So okay. There's that.
Okay. Okay, so one more confusing piece that I have to bring up. Where do those Cardassian neck bones go when they try to make them look human or maybe Bajoran?
I've always wondered that.
I mean, you would think, like, Seska, those neck bones should have been pretty darn prevalent. They don't, obviously, they need them to hold their head up. Because, let me tell you, those Cardassians got big heads.
Yep. Actually, you're right. And if you think about it, humans are the best spies, best people to go undercover, because you always have to add something to the humans to make them look like aliens rather than taking things away.
Yeah. So I like to know where those neck bones go.
And unless they're just, it's ornamental skin and it's not actually a part. I don't know. I can't even think of what I'm trying to say. Mm. Like, there's no bones in there. Maybe it's just the way the flesh looks.
Mm.
But even so, you'd have to take it off and leave it somewhere, right?
I think we need to do a Cardassian autopsy.
Or maybe it's like a tattoo. Yeah, their version of a tattoo.
There you go.
And they're required to get it, too. Children have to have them. Women have to have them.
It's a coming-of-age thing.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And now, of course, we meet Gulmaset.
Gulmaset, yeah.
Who obviously, played by Mark Alamo, who will go on to be Gul Dukat.
Yes.
My guess is, and I did go through Memory Alpha on this episode, but I don't recall seeing anything, but my guess was the person who wrote this episode would have been probably paid royalties in perpetuity through the entire run of DS9 by using the name Gulmaset.
Well, Well, that's why Tom Paris is not Nick Locarno, right?
And there we go. That's true. Although Tom Paris' story was very, very similar. He didn't follow orders or something, and you know, hot-dogged it, and people died. More people died than what Nicholas Locarno killed, but...
Yeah.
So what do we think of the Cardassian appearance? To me, they look pretty scaly, and I'm trying to think snake-like or something, but pretty awesome.
Yeah, and their appearance actually didn't change all the way through except for the color.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something that I think let me like cheerlead here slightly, because you know, this is a one-off throwaway episode of Next Gen. I don't think at this point people were thinking very far ahead. I think by the time like Ensign Rowe comes in later in season 5, I do think that they have plans of making these guys recurring characters. But this is just a one-time baddie, I suppose. The design on the Cardassians themselves is great, and it's a testament to how well it is that they didn't change, you know, really that much throughout the S9. And you know, they come in as iconic, you know, maybe not the top tier aliens, but they're certainly the second rung of, you know, aliens that all Trek fans will know. You know, you just go to Star Trek Las Vegas, see who's talking. A fair number of them have got their Cardassian faces up, so they're very popular. The other thing is that in addition to the design on the makeup, in this episode you also introduced the two designs of ship as well. The Gallo-class Cardassian ship, which again remains throughout the DS9 run. Yeah. And again, it doesn't change. It's a great designed ship. I always feel it looks like a fish in my mind. It's like a little flat fish. But you know, that's a nice designed ship. And the Nebula class is, I think I've gone down on record of saying, it's certainly, I think it's my favorite design Federation starship, full stop.
Really?
I love the design on it. I think it's just, I know that they've kind of taken a Galaxy class and they've kind of made it a little bit snugger, but I just really love the design of the Phoenix. And whenever it comes up every now and again on DS9, and you know, there's even that really sucky episode it comes up on in DS9, where I think it's Second Sight, where Sisko's dreaming of a woman who happens to be inhabiting the body of
nonsense like that. With the sun, they have to blow up.
But they're on a Nebula class ship, and I think, yeah, it's not all that bad. I just love this design ship.
Okay.
I would have figured out it was just the ghost of the woman, probably about the second date. Maybe the second time she disappeared. I think I would have figured it out. Maybe not. Okay. So what do you think about they being the Cardassian aboard? I mean, could you not just cut O'Brien's hatred with a knife?
Yes.
I mean, that was pretty awesome when Deanna's walking out and she's just like, whoa, and looks back at him.
Yep.
Well, hang on. You're assuming here that O'Brien's thinking something nasty about the Cardassians. He might just be thinking something very inappropriate about Troy.
Nice bum, Troy.
Nice bum.
And she turns around, you what? No, but you guys are, of course, right. It is something that threads through this episode in terms of O'Brien coming to terms with, you know, what he carries from Sedlak 3. And I do think it's... I don't think at any point in this episode you feel like O'Brien's kind of a bad guy or in the wrong. But he does, you know, he does have this kind of shades of grey that they're able to play well and to work him through. And considering that at this point he really isn't that much of a large character, a central character in TNG, I think it's episodes like this and the previous one that really, I think, elevate O'Brien. And then let me just put it down there, you know, in terms of Colm Meaney's performance, it's also great. And they just, you know, in this episode they can feed him a huge amount of character development. And, you know, the actor just takes it on board and just eats it up and puts together a great performance of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. He really had no background before this, didn't he?
No.
Not really.
No, he was just in the transporter room or the guy sitting at Khan on the first episode.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that it's such a minor character. He was there from the first day of the Next Generation, almost to the last.
Mm-hmm.
there for the first day of DS9 all the way to the last. So
he,
I think
he was in the fun fact, he was in the pilot and the finale of two Star Trek series.
Yeah.
It's because he obviously came in and he came in all good things to reprise his role at the in the quote past timeline.
Yeah. So I can't think of any minor character that had such luck on Star Trek.
True.
Okay, so what do you guys... Well, and then, of course, he pops off with the Cardassians in the turbo lift.
Yeah, that was out of nowhere, eh?
That was what?
Almost out of nowhere.
Oh, what?
Pent out of nowhere.
Oh, out of nowhere. Well, yeah, I mean, they're trying to, you know, pimp information out of them already. How do your transporters work?
Actually, I did like that scene. I think he does turn very quickly, right? He's obviously got a bit of latent aggression there. But there's the bit where he's like rolling up saying, you know, if my captain orders me to, you know, show you this, then I will. And if he asks me to escort you there, then I will. But who I choose to spend my free time with is my own business. So, hey, let's go and play racquetball. I didn't know if he was going to... He might have done a switcheroo there at the end.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go to the holodeck and do some kayaking.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, try and drown one of them. If you hear the words "computer safety's off," get out quickly.
Oh yeah.
Oh, because it looks like he was about ready to run one of them down until they got out of his way. But okay, let's talk about the ship's coded transponder frequency.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing that gets popped out that never comes back again. That, to me, says the Cardassian ships could never have found the Phoenix had they not known their ship's coded transponder frequency.
No, I don't think that's it, right? I think that they could have done, but they could have, but it would have taken them a longer time. So the actual kind of, you know, the search would have been longer.
Yeah, and doesn't the transponder just give you all the information about what the ship is, like its armaments and its class and all that good stuff?
You wouldn't think you'd want a transponder to do anything like that.
Well, the bad guys usually can't read that, but the good guys can read each other's.
As well as bad guys.
Yeah, because we can read all the stuff, because yes, we're that good.
We know everything about them, as they're just finding out.
Oh, that's right.
You can read our transponder. Well, obviously, duh. We can make that determination.
Actually, let me just throw in here that there's a lot of interactions that take place on the bridge, and there's a lot of interactions, you know, like when they're doing this transponder thing and stuff. And I think something that might just go unnoticed is that I think Picard is very well written. He interacts with everyone and how he is able to be, you know, diplomatic but also firm when necessary and challenge when necessary, and at no point does he lose it. I think he could have been very, you know, I think you walk away from this and you look at Picard and you and how well he interacts with everyone and takes control of the situation, you think, well, this guy is an absolute diplomat from top to bottom. How he handles the transponder, how he handles the fact that there's raising tension during the fight, and you know they're potentially going to have the Phoenix blow up another ship and stuff. All of that is handled in a very cool, calm manner that I wouldn't necessarily be able to see it transposed over to Kirk or to Janeway without there being, you know, in Kirk's case, a bit of, you know, too much cockiness, and in Janeway's case, I suppose, I think Janeway actually also had a bit of cockiness, frankly, even though it's coming from a different place. Whereas here, it's really much... I think it's a great... I think it's Picard written at his best.
Diplomat.
Yes.
He's an achieved diplomat.
I agree with everything you just said.
But disagrees with everything I just said. Okay. Well, I think the Phoenix might want to change its transponder frequency after this episode. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like a transponder frequency sounds... It sounded like, you know, how are they supposed to find him? And then when they finally get the... Later on, they get the transponder frequency. you know, the Phoenix would not have a chance. Well, obviously, that ain't true either.
Yeah. So I think I've always read Worf as that, you know, if they were... Yeah, no, actually, no. What I was about to say doesn't make sense. You're right. I defer.
You would think that the Cardassians still have sensors and can see what else is around, right? What we have another starship on long-range sensors. We can't read their transponder code, but we know they're there.
Yeah, right.
So there's that.
So basically it's saying that if the Federation didn't know their transponder frequency, they'd have to look out a window to tell it it's a Cardassian ship?
No, I think they could still tell it's a Cardassian ship. They just wouldn't know all the information.
Now, I always consider this to be kind of the equivalent of where you have at the moment with airplanes, where, you know, you can probably detect an airplane by radar, but if you are, you know, knowing the transponder frequency, effectively allows you to read the signals it's sending back and, you know, the location and you know, more information. So how I think much, it's going from kind of, you know, it's going from kind of being grey on the radar with not knowing a lot to being kind of, you know, very lit up and a lot of info on the plane stroke starship.
Mm. How much fuel is left and
how many passengers?
Mm. Okay. Flight,
where are you going? But then we get some nice O'Brien singing at dinner.
Oh, definitely. But let's talk about how Keiko was mortified at the potato casserole.
Your mom touched meat?
She touched it and cut it? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I always do that to my daughter when she says, oh, my God. I go, oh, my God. She hates that. But that's kind of the way she looked like.
Yeah.
You know, OMG, LOL, what is this? But what was it? I mean, to me, it looked like mashed potatoes with meat in it. What are capers?
Capers are little vegetable kind of thingy-majigs. The wife has capers. They're just... they're like small olive things.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Hey, you know something?
Very bad at describing that.
I just had a thought, and I don't know where this came from, James, but as I was asking, what are capers? And I just had a thought that actually there is something you can bring for me. Would you bring me a box of crumpets?
Lou, I'm way ahead of you.
I got to have a box of crumpets.
Do they come in a box or a bag?
I don't have a clue.
They don't come in a box. No, they come in a bag. It's okay. Like, can you bring a box of bread?
Okay.
I'm afraid they come in a bag.
So I was expecting like little croutons or something.
No, they're like wafers. Like a flat, like a burger bun, right? But not like that. But
yeah, I mean, we do have crumpets sold at McDonald's around here. it's not a high quality item that gets individually wrapped.
Over here, we call them English muffins.
What?
Yeah, English muffins. You know, when you go to the coffee shop and you want a breakfast sandwich, and it's an English muffin cut in half with cheese and egg on it, and maybe bacon or sausage.
So kind of like McDonald's English muffin.
Exactly. That's what a crumpet is.
Are you serious?
I'm pretty sure.
Because I tell you, when we first started doing this show, and crumpets... I think it was one of the episodes that talked about crumpets, and I did a Google search to no end, trying to find out where I could get a crumpet, could I get it sent to me, and there was absolutely no way to find one here.
See, that's because British people are fancy, and they just have cool names for things, and we over here just call them English muffins.
All right, well, bring one anyway. Gotta have one from home.
And maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's not an English muffin. Maybe it is something different that I don't know about.
Mm. Okay, well, maybe we'll have a... Okay,
so I have Googled it. It's in my opinion, it's not quite an English muffin, but imagine an English muffin, something that was half English muffin, half plastic. And I think you're getting closer.
To crumpets?
Yeah, because this still looks like it has some resemblance to bread.
Oh, yeah, English mushroom, yeah, whatever.
Wow,
resemblance to bread. Okay, All right. Well, we talked about the dinner and the potato casserole, you know, dish fit for kings, and she didn't quite feel kingly. But you know, and then he, you know, he gets a spoon and it globs it on her plate. So I can imagine she's like, "Oh boy, this is not right." But then he goes into the singing. So you take it from there, Sean.
No, that's it. He just didn't realize that he was singing, but all this business with Captain Maxwell must have brought it up, because that was their song they sung.
Yeah, yeah.
The minstrel boy to the war is gone or something.
And I thought that was made up, but it's actually real.
Yeah, it's from 1798 or something, according to Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Or everybody else. Is this the scene where Clank O'Brien and Keiko talk about, you know, why do have some people have problems with Cardassian?
Yeah. And, why do people still feel however they feel? As he just about decked two Cardassians in the turbo lift.
Yeah. Sure, but I like this. I like the fact that O'Brien has a wife to come home to talk to. And I think that...
That's all I do.
No, I think this is a good kind of a good character scene. You don't have to... You know, you are placing the discussion of this episode, which is around, you know, which is about revenge, about how long do you hold on to grudges, about, you know, seeing the enemy as dehuman, and you're turning it into a discussion around a kitchen table that you have with your wife. And I know I'm completely out there in crazy land, but I like Keiko, and I like the fact that she allows these conversations to happen in a more, you know, human, natural setting.
Right. Yeah, it's good.
But we never see her take a bite of her potato casserole.
Well, you don't eat TV food. Everybody knows that.
Oh. Well, that's true. How many times they have to do it over and over again?
Yeah.
Okay. And, of course, there. You know, I also found out today that there were some outtakes from this episode. Have you guys seen those?
I read about it on Memory Alpha, but didn't look at them.
All right, I'm going to put a link in the no, that ain't it. I'll put a link to where you can find them, and hopefully I'll remember to put it in the show notes as well.
Okay.
I suck at this lately. Okay, so so how should anyone feel the way they feel? Okay, yeah, we've already passed that. And so after the Phoenix destroys two Cardassian ships... we need to catch up to them, but, you know, we're kind of like snailing along at warp 4, so it's going to take a while. Do you think Picard maybe should have hit warp 9?
Sooner?
Quite a bit sooner. But I guess, you know, the story would have gone too quick.
Yes.
They always do this. They always have this, you know, like, oh, how long is it going to take us to get there? When, well, we're going like 12 miles an hour. Do you want me to actually put some welly on here? Why are you going on at warp 4? It's ridiculous.
Do you think there's speed limits in space?
Well, not until season 7.
Yeah. I suppose that there probably has to be, to a certain extent, but it doesn't quite make sense I've seen that explanation of the warp scale, and it's supposed to be a logarithmic scale, which basically means, you know, warp 5 is a hell of a lot faster than warp 4, which is a hell of a lot faster than warp 3. It's not like you're going, you know, 2 miles an hour, 3 miles an hour, 4 miles an hour. It's more like you're going, you know, 10 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour, 1,000 miles an hour.
Exponentially, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about it being, you know, warp 4 versus warp 9 points, whatever, you're probably like thousands of factors away. So why would you ever consider going at warp 4 under those circumstances? It makes no sense.
Because by the time you got there, it would be an even amount. It'd be 5 hours instead of 4 hours and 12 minutes, because everything has to be, you know, equal and rounded.
Yeah, sure. But you end up in a position like, you know, oh, we have to go and fly to Vulcan. Oh, how fast would we go? Well, I want to get there next week, warp 8. Well, why do we go warp 4? Oh, you'll get there in 42,000 years.
Yeah.
I mean, what? Why would you ever need that scale?
Right.
I don't have an answer.
Yeah. That's like when they're trying to catch up to people that are going to crash on Tasha Yar's home world. What was the name of it?
Not a clue.
That planet. You know, we're going at warp 2 and then we increased to warp 9 and 9.5. So I guess, you know, warp 9 versus 9.5. How exponential is that?
Lots.
Lots. Okay. It's not you I hate, Cardassian. I hate what I became because of you.
That's not the episode.
It wasn't, but yeah, that I thought it was one of the best lines too. So, anything on that, Doc?
Only that this episode has various scenes, whether it's O'Brien and the Cardassian, whether it's O'Brien and Picard, whether it's O'Brien and Maxwell, Picard and Maxwell. They're not. You know, there's a lot of these personal scenes that there are, where they have a conversation in a realistic setting and they learn something about each other, and it all seems to make a lot of sense, and it all seems to work. You know, it all seems to work very well and very nicely, in terms of character development and stuff. And I think it's not really a, you know, this episode isn't really like a big episode with big explosions and stuff. In fact, I can't even. There's no phaser fired on screen, right?
Well, there's a bit at the beginning where Golmaset and Picard are shooting at each other a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right.
But for the most part, it's all on the view screen with numbers and overlays and stuff.
Indeed, and I've got in my like notes about how Maset and Picard kind of play generals, like, you know, moving or, you know, talking about the deployment of the ships and the movement of the ships. And the action takes place in that environment, whilst allowing the personal story development to take place at the on the personal level. So overall, I agree. I think it's very good that this episode gets really, the highlights of this episode are the kind of one-to-one conversations that take place and that are dotted really throughout the episode. I mean, I like the one, I think it was just before it, but I like the one where Picard and O'Brien are talking to each other and they have this kind of heart-to-heart, and mm-hmm. you know, Picard knows that Maxwell has again kind of blown up another ship, whereas O'Brien doesn't know that, and he's very, very forthcoming and volunteering how great Maxwell is as a guy, and you can see that Picard himself he's uncomfortable about this enthusiasm that O'Brien has for his old captain, and then when he reveals the fact that actually he's done something bad again, you know. Really, O'Brien's kind of slightly flawed, and he says, "Well, you know, I don't know what to say."
He must have had his reasons,
and then he must have had his reasons, and then you also pick up things in O'Brien's speech where he refers to the Cardassians as, you know, those people, and it's very, in my mind, I think it's very, very strong writing
mm-hmm.
in all of these little scenes that we have.
Hmm. And it becomes comfortable, like old leather, huh? But I do agree that, you know, it becomes so familiar that, you know, you can't ever remember feeling any other way. And so, but O'Brien does come around with the Cardassians eventually. Not for a while, but eventually. So we're to believe that Golmaset knew nothing of Glenn Tillo's attempt to access Federation files on the ship's weapon system.
Well, just look at the guy. He looks like a hoodlum.
Yeah.
Sneaky.
So obviously there weren't guards around that sensitive area of the ship.
Guards around the green.
So I'd actually quite like to get your opinion on what you guys thought though about that. Do you think that, you know, the Maset character knew and expected this to be happening, or do you think he's really taken aback?
Well, based on what we know about Klingons, of course they knew. They're sneaky. They're bad. They're like snakes.
Because I think you can read it either way, and I try my best to figure out which they're trying to get across or trying to put across to the audience. And actually, I can't figure out how I'm expected to read this. I think it can be really...
intentionally...
It's so ambiguous. Down the line.
Yeah.
It's very, very much so. And... You know, I think that we have this. If it had been Dukat, by the way, and Dukat is played different to Maset, but had it been Dukat, you'd know straight away. Yeah, you know, you're complete full of BS. Of course, you ordered the guy to do it, and you know, because he had actually Dukat would almost have like a more of an over the top reaction to, oh, you know, why did you get, you know, why did you do this? I'm now going to exterminate your family, kind of thing. But the way that Maset plays it, And also the way that Massette has been with Picard, and I think we actually learn enough about Massette to know that he's not an extremist. I have no idea whether or not Gold Massette ordered this or not.
Here's kind of what I thought.
Was he comfortable with it or not?
I wonder if he's angry because he got caught. I kind of thought that Gol Massette's apology to Picard about the Glenn trying to get a little information off a computer seemed a hell of a lot better than Picard ever tries for all those 700 lives that were lost, not including the space station.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if he, you know, if we were talking what we know about Gol Dukat, then obviously he's pissed because he got caught. But here, I'm not so sure. I didn't read that on Gol Massette.
No, he seems pretty trustworthy as far as Cardassian goes.
But, you know, if I was Picard, I'd be at least a little curious, you know, instead of saying, well, you can take whatever action against him you feel is necessary. I got to be wondering, is it going to be some kind of humanitarian rights violation going to happen when he gets home? Pull his scales right out of the side of his neck? What's going to happen to that guy when he gets home?
He's going to get strung up by his neck cords.
You would think. Cardassians are pretty ruthless as far as we know in the future. Okay. All right, so... if O'Brien... You know, I'm sorry, what?
No, go ahead.
Captain Maxwell comes aboard, and he identifies O'Brien as his tactical officer on the Rutledge. So it sounds like, and we saw O'Brien at Khan. I don't think we ever saw him at tactical till later. But why is he wasting his time down in the transporter room?
Because he's waiting to be an engineer on a space station.
Oh. He's been holding out forever.
Okay, you know what I want to talk about? What is O'Brien's actual rank? Because sometimes he's a regular Starfleet officer and sometimes he's an enlisted man, and I don't know what the difference is.
Let me do it. He's a chief petty officer.
Yeah, what does that
at
mean?
At this stage he's not, though, right? He's technically lieutenant, full lieutenant at this
stage. Because he's got the two solid pips.
Yes.
But actually, this is one of the things that does wind me up, and I don't know whether or not at this point he's technically an enlisted man who has been given the rank of lieutenant, but it's like an honorary rank, and then later on they come to him and said, hey, O'Brien, about that honorary rank, well, we've now designed a new badge for you, which basically puts you at the bottom of the pile, so yeah, if you could wear that, that would be great. Or I don't know if he used to be an official guy that then got, you know, that then decided to leave and then was enticed back as a contractor on better pay, but on a lower rank. I have no idea what's going on here.
Yeah, does it mean that he didn't go to the academy?
Right.
Is that basically what happened?
They've mentioned on numerous occasions that he hasn't gone to the academy.
Okay.
But he can't be the only guy on the ship that didn't go to the academy.
Right. It makes no sense to me.
I mean, your chief transporter officer didn't go to the academy, but you know what? The third deputy transporter officer did? I mean, that makes no sense.
And how does he know all this stuff? He must have gone to some kind of school.
He was a tactical officer, too. So.
Yeah, but, I mean, he also ends up teaching at the academy as well. the ironies.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the worst thing is, I don't think it added anything to O'Brien's character that he had this weird rank that no one quite could pinpoint.
I think it mattered in one episode. I think it mattered in only one DS9 episode where he points out that when Nog graduates the academy, he's going to have to call him sir.
Right.
I think that's the only reason that ever became relevant to the chief petty officer thing.
And also, hang on, while we're here and on DS9, so the episode Valiant, right, with Red Squad, they have people in Red Squad that are at the academy that go onto this trading mission. One person chooses to take the role of chief petty officer. What? That makes no sense. Right?
They are like...
You know what I'm referring to?
Yeah. They're the explorers. Is what we have over here is a group, you know, called the explorers in different professions. But that doesn't, like, for instance, when I was 16, I was in the Law Enforcement Explorers, learn about police work. That doesn't mean that I was able to ride a squad car with a gun strapped to my hip.
Okay.
Right. So I don't understand why Red Squad is able to do all that they're able to do.
No, sure. But let's just say that you were in Red Squad and you did take control of the ship. Are we really believing that there's... Why would they be taking over the Chief Petty Officer's role from someone who's at the Academy? I mean, you want to take over the ship's cook role with someone at the Academy? It seems like a step down. But it doesn't matter.
Almost like they were actors. And I don't mean actors as in obviously where they were played by actors. But I mean, it's almost like the ship is full of actors pretending to be real officers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like, you know, people who impersonate the police or something. They want to be it, but they can never be that. So they go out and impersonate it. But this is sanctioned by Starfleet, or at least some part of Starfleet. The other half don't know anything about it.
Let me just, with us getting back to the episode, let me just point out that we don't see Maxwell, Captain Maxwell, in this episode until just slightly over half the way in.
Yeah.
However, despite that, this episode is, you know, the character, the performance that he gives, and the amount of importance that he is to the story. You know, you would never think that he's only in half the episode.
No, and he's very personable. He's almost like Admiral Preston from Pressman from the episode where there's the Phaedus ship.
Yeah,
the Pegasus. Yeah, like they're kind of the same kind of person.
Right.
Yeah. Very jubilant and excitable and whatever.
Yeah. You could definitely see yourself under his command.
Yeah. Exactly.
Actually, I do like the I absolutely love the scene between Picard and Maxwell in the ready room. First, I'm going to be slightly flippant here in that Maxwell goes in there and he basically says, "Okay, it's good that I'm dealing with you, Picard, because you know what it's out like here." And about 2 seconds later, he's accusing him to have sold out to the man.
And it's stuffy, like a bureaucrat's office.
That's great. But actually, the way that Picard plays it and the way that he phrases, he basically rebuts him with questions like, you know, "Oh, who did you get the information from? You know, where's your documentation? You know, whose lives were at stake? You know, why did he have to act now?" All of that stuff is, it shows Picard being analytical and being able to be detached and actually take the proper decisions that are needed. Whereas Maxwell, on the other hand, has become emotional.
I did what had to be done.
Act on faith.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
Right. But that's the thing. I mean, what had to be done? Why? For whom? Like you say, in Maxwell, he can't answer these very, very simple questions about why this had to be done, for whom, what are we talking about here? But in the end, do you feel that Maxwell is actually right? Or did you think he was off his meds at that time?
Well, I think he's off his med. I don't think he's right. I don't think he's right in what he's done. I do think he's got too close, too personal, and has like lost perspective. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't right, or in terms of the facts of what was going on. And it also doesn't necessarily mean that had he followed through with it, the world or the universe would have been a better place. Because obviously appeasing the Cardassians, 6 or 7 years down the line, these guys are like a huge force with the Dominion War. So, you know, maybe they should have been confronted.
I kind of get a little of what Maxwell was saying, though. What am I supposed to do? Just make my report and then let the bureaucrats sit around and read it for the next 30 years and do absolutely nothing? Or I could prove to them that I'm right. I mean, even Kirk would... What would Kirk have done in Captain Maxwell's place? Seems like Kirk probably would have done the same thing and had been proven he was right all along.
That's yeah, right. That is what Kirk would have done. So the Kirk character would have been written that he would have done something that would have led to him being perhaps have a slap on the wrist or at least a word from command, but he would have been able to get out of it and proven that these guys were in the wrong. And you would have then warped away after acknowledging that these guys were in the wrong, and almost, you know, and that's the end of the story. Whereas I think the more grown up, truthful approach that kind of TNG has taken is that you can't really have that kind of cowboy mentality. And even if you want to prove them wrong, right? He does this thing where he heads off to another ship later on in the episode and says, look, board the ship, you'll see that I'm right. You can't operate under those circumstances when you're respecting the chain of command and the diplomatic missions that are at stake. I think it's a much more grown-up view. And frankly, had you boarded the ship and proved to them that they were in the wrong, Picard mentioned this, you would have had a war. You would have had things get out of control very, very quickly. Which I like it that, you know, I've mentioned, I think it shows TNG has been a much more grown-up show to acknowledge that there are these consequences of your action. Whereas Kirk would have just gone, hey, you know, you're in the wrong, and the bad guys would have gone, oh dear, we've been found out. And it also shows Picard as being like the true diplomat.
Okay. What if the Federation hadn't been almost ass-handed to them by the Borg? I mean, Admiral Hayden, he just says that, you know, I don't have to tell you, the Federation is not prepared for a new sustained conflict. I mean, they're rebuilding the fleet. What if the Borg had never come by? Then maybe a war wouldn't have been such a big deal after all.
And we would have had the Dominion War in Season 5 of Next Generation.
Hmm.
Maybe, no, but I
probably think, not.
I don't know. I don't know how you would have the Dominion War so soon.
You wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't have had the Dominion War, but you would have had the kind of escalation of the conflict in the Alpha Quadrant. But I think that really they're not writing it from the perspective of hurry or rushing that conflict. They're writing it from the perspective that, you know, you can't, it's wrong for you to force the hand of an enemy, even if the enemy is in the wrong. In certain circumstances, and I think this shows an example of why, despite being right, I think it's mentioned at the end about how, you know, Maxwell hasn't managed to find a place in the piece. You know, despite being right, despite being technically on the correct side of the argument, you can't go and behave like this in the new kind of peaceful times. And I think that that was really the commentary that they were trying to put across.
Right. Makes sense. Okay, so we already discussed a high-energy subspace field, which Voyager really could have used. Because then, you know, their enemies wouldn't have known what they were capable of or what they were holding or what was inside the ship, because you can't scan it. But how about when O'Brien comes on to the, you know, Picard calls for O'Brien to the bridge, and the Phoenix is using a high energy sensor system which cycles every 5.5 minutes, and between cycles is a window of a 50th of a second.
How does he know that?
Well, because he's smart. He's a pretty much an engineer.
Right.
So, he's kind of an engineer. He's a tactical engineer who works on the who beams people up and down. But I was thinking more along the lines of, we could have turned to Gul Masset and said, did you get that?
Yeah, do we really have to say that in front of the party?
You know.
I didn't notice that.
Really? Yeah, because, you know, you're here with my staff, you're hearing reports as I hear them, you're hearing classified information as I hear it. It's all good.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all friends here. So I think the Phoenix needs to cycle every 7.8 minutes now instead of 5.5.
Yeah.
But still that window of a 50th of a second. And I may not be good with math, but I got to imagine, can a transporter beam really get through that fast?
Well, he cycled it with the computer till it was all automated, so that's how it works.
But then how did he get the information of when the next cycle was going to come? And it had to have been...
Hey, don't get too deep into this. We're going to pull it apart.
Actually, more seriously, though, every now and again in stories, people forget that you're not allowed to beam through shields.
Right.
It happens a fair bit. The fact that at least that they've acknowledged that, hey, by the way, you probably shouldn't beam through a shield. Oh, can we get around that somehow? Yeah, sure. This 3 lines worth of dialogue will get you around it. That's all I need from the story. It seems, you know, is it reasonable that their sensor is on a cycle? Yeah. Could there possibly be a gap between the cycle? Sure. Can someone get through the gap? Why not?
O'Brien can.
Indeed.
Yeah. Right. Well, that just means, obviously, all Federation ships have a cycle every something. It's just depending on what the ship is. Do all of the Phoenix class or whatever class they're using?
Nebula
class. They're all Nebula class starships. Cycle every 5.5 minutes. Who decided 5.5? Why not 4.7? Or there's a window of a 47th of a second. Or I don't know. Get it, 47, guys.
Yeah, I caught that. Okay. That was good. That was a good one, Lou.
Just want to make sure.
Yeah. Good job, buddy.
Thank you.
I didn't get it.
All right, so O'Brien beams over for a sing-along.
You have to put that in right here.
The minstrel boy to the war has gone. In the ranks of death you will find him. His father's sword he hath girded on, and his wild harp slung behind him. Land of song, said the warrior bard, though all the world betrays thee, one sword at least thy rights shall guard, one faithful harp shall praise thee.
Yeah, but hang on a second. Whoa. don't dismiss this. No. This kind of, you know, heart to heart, you know, proper.
I'm not going to win this one, am I, Chief? No, sir.
Yeah, by the way, throughout this episode, we've not been touching on like the how well paced and how much the drama and the tension builds up. It has been building up, and despite it not having like lots of action, despite it being kind of a relative, almost a bottle show, right? It's just, you know, filmed on in a very small number of locations.
Yeah.
You know, when Maxwell goes, the tension really gets ramped up. You don't know what he's going to do. You don't know how you're getting out of this.
Because we didn't mention the fact that Picard let Maxwell retain the command of his own ship on the way to Starbase 211.
Yeah.
And then we catch him, and then O'Brien beams over.
Yeah, and when, you know, this entire kind of storyline is diffused by two guys having what I think is a greatly written, kind of very human story between themselves as they chat about things, as they remember old times, and as they, you know, as they discuss what the options are. And I think it's absolutely not heartbreaking. I think it's wonderful how it ends with Maxwell going, "No, I'm not going to win this one, am I?" And he goes, "No, sir." And then it cuts to black, and you think, "Wow, you've got everything you need to put across about Maxwell's motivations and where he's going from here."
Well, that was a great scene.
He's just in these couple of lines he has with O'Brien. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. And they sing Stompy's song.
Stompy's song. Where do you think he's going from here, though? I mean, Picard says, you know, he couldn't find the role for himself in peace. You know, we could pity him, but we're not going to dismiss him. What exactly does that mean? Is he going to some kind of court-martial, or...?
He's going to psychological reconditioning via the Tantalus device.
Ooh. He gets to stare at the spinning lights.
Exactly.
Is that not the neuron neutralizer?
There you go. That's right.
Yeah. Counseling. In other words, he's going to get lots and lots of counseling.
So he's got a choice of, you can go into this room, stare into the neural neutralizer, we'll probably forget to turn it off, and you're going to be reduced to a gibbering wreck, or counsel at Troy's offices this way.
Neutralizer, please.
He chooses the trauma.
Unless she's wearing the blue dress with the crazy cleavage part thing.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
She's never crazy. Come on.
That's a good dress.
Oh, wait a second. You mean her Federation?
No. No, that weird blue dress with the neckline that's all wonky.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's no neckline. It's a chest line.
There you go.
It's also asymmetric. And
yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I'm saying.
It's not supposed to be attractive, right? Most people usually symmetricity is better.
It's attractive,
but I suppose when I say asymmetric isn't attractive, it's in this particular case it's like saying having one boob out isn't attractive.
Yeah, that's disgusting. I won't stand for that.
Terrible, terrible. All right. Well, maybe Mrs. Dr. Roberts is in the next room and he's trying to not get in trouble. Yes, I was completely turned on by that blue dress. What? No, I didn't mean that, honey. Sorry. Well, maybe not. Okay, but I'm just saying, you know, I'm curious where he would have gone on from now. Does he ever get the command of a starship again? Do they drum him out of the Federation? Or?
Oh, you haven't read the novels?
No, I don't.
Oh, novels.
I don't have any idea. I don't read them either.
I mean, I would imagine he's, you know, court-martialed. He's not going to be in Starfleet again. He'll probably serve a lengthy prison time.
Probably joins Maquis.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it got very popular right around like season four or so of DS9. Just basically have any of your previous characters and say, oh yeah, they probably joined the Maquis. I mean, I'm sure there are other things that people can do, even people that are slightly disenfranchised with society at the time, than join the Maquis. So I personally wouldn't like that, but I can certainly see it. I'm sure it's a kind of, given his history with the Kardashians, it's an obvious fallback.
Yeah. Yeah. But then we know he's dead because all Maquis were slaughtered, weren't they? Except not for all those in the Delta Quadrant.
No, there's always a few that escapes. But anyway.
Okay. All right. So, you know, obviously, well, Maxwell and O'Brien were together. Those were some pretty awesome scenes, and you know, you could feel Maxwell's pain. It was just very, very clear. Yep. Butcher women and children in their homes, and you know, how many Cardassian women and children were killed during the war?
800,742.
847.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I don't know. Or 47,474.7.
Yes.
Shut up, Lou.
All right. So Massette thinks that O'Brien has some misplaced loyalty to Maxwell.
Right. Because O'Brien defends him all the way to the end. Oh, what he did was terribly wrong. Yeah, I know that, but he still was a great guy. So what he did, was it terribly wrong?
Well, he probably shouldn't have killed all those people, but they're just spoonheads. What do they matter? They don't feel like we feel.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Of course, I'm kidding.
Of these Cardassians, seem like they feel like we do. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I wish Star Trek for a series. I would love to have seen Star Trek in the eyes of the enemy.
Ooh, from yes.
For a season with the Romulans and how they go on their lives and the Cardassians, the Klingons, you know.
And how about Star Trek Stargazer, the Picard years? That would be an awesome series.
Oh, yes, it would.
Except with James McAvoy.
That would be, you know, really, I don't know. So I thought that would be nice to see Star Trek in the eyes of the enemy.
Yes. Can we get that going? Maybe that'll be season two of Discovery.
Yeah, right. Yes. No one's ever thought of that but me.
No, of course not.
So, Picard leaves Golden Set with that stern warning.
We'll be watching?
We'll be watching. Because we're voyeurs. We'll be watching.
If I had gone aboard those ships, we wouldn't be having this very nice conversation.
No, I think he's right. I mean, at some point, couldn't Picard say, look, I don't want to board the ship, but why don't you turn off that high-energy sensor system? Show Maxwell that he's wrong.
But here's, I mean, what the equivalence here is, right, is that let's say that I decided to take a UK battleship into American waters, and I happen to find kind of an American, you know, ship that's flying under the American flag, and I demand to board the ship. It's, you know, you're not allowed to do that. It's out of Federation space, or at least I think it's at least in the neutral zone. It's another person's property that you don't have jurisdiction over, and I like the fact that Picard is so clear that he's not gonna, you know, he's not gonna play with this, and it's not necessarily because he doesn't think that Maxwell might have a point or even basis of probability might be correct, but it's not the appropriate channel for this thing to be followed. And if that means that this week, you know, the bad guys might have pulled a fast one over us, then, you know, it is what it is. But you have to rise above it.
So at this point, is the Cardassian still occupying Bajor? Yep. I suppose.
I think so.
It sure seems like it. Yeah.
Or they're on their way out or something. Yeah, it's pretty close, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, because you think Deep Space Nine starts, what, season 5 or 6?
Yeah, halfway through 5, I think.
No, halfway through 6.
Is it 6?
6?
Yeah.
All right, okay. So they're still on Bajor. Yeah,
we still get Rascals, right? With yes. Brian in it.
Oh, yeah.
that's right.
Rascals. Oh, my God. Okay.
I hope I signed up for that one.
I don't know. But yeah, that's quite a bizarre one. I think the worst person who has it on Rascals is O'Brien. When he has his 12-year-old snuggling up to him.
We've had this discussion before.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, let's not go there. That's a rabbit hole.
Well, we'll be going there, but unfortunately, that'll come later. Okay, so we will be watching. Okay, one thing I'm curious, Doc. I don't know if I've ever asked you this. So I may end up putting in our schoolless thing here. But this is one that I got a feeling you're probably going to become very annoyed to try and explain. But when Golmsett walks out of the room after Picard turns around and looks out the window, we see all these stars flying by. Now, to the layman who doesn't really work in anything that has to do with space or the Big Bang or relativity, whatever, those just look like little rocks. That's
a very small subset of the of the audience. Those of us that don't work in relativity.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. Yeah. Okay, I keep hearing those are stars, and each one of those little lights is a star system, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like one of those little lights is another star system just like our star system. Or are they just seem like white rocks that are in space that we just go past very fast, and they're lit up, and every time we pass them real quick, that's what makes them look like they're... What exactly are stars? Like I said, that was probably gonna frustrate you trying to explain what that really means.
Get your books out, kids, because Dr. Roberts is about to school ya.
Okay, so what exactly is a star? So, well, first of all, there are various phases to stars, so they can start out in one way and then kind of end up in others. But generally, what you're talking about when you're talking about a star is just a kind of a huge, giant, flaming mass of usually hydrogen and helium that are being fused together in a huge nuclear reaction that's producing a huge amount of light. So all it is that, you know, you've got these, you know, you've got these gases that have become, that's become very large, become very, you know, concentrated. There's a huge amount of pressure there, and it just is a kind of, you know, it is an ongoing kind of, you know, big nuclear fusion reaction that's taking place.
Oh.
And it will sit there, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. In the sense, by the way, that when I say bigger, it is, you know, it's making heavier and heavier and heavier elements inside it as it's fusing together the hydrogen into helium and then eventually like heavier heavier elements. And it gives off, as it's doing that, it's giving off a lot of a lot of energy.
Okay. And I'm right that by the time we actually see a star, it's been burnt out how many thousand years ago?
I'm not entirely sure that that's true, but we're certainly seeing things from in the past, right? So I think if we're around 5 light years away from our nearest star, by the time the light gets to us, it's obviously 5 years old.
Okay. And so when we're at warp, some of them are just flying past us, while others are just kind of like slowly gliding by.
Yeah, it'll be just that, and that will basically be due to perspective, right? So one star will be a very, very long way away, and as we're rushing towards it, we don't see it move relative to the position. Whereas other ones will be closer, and you'll see them like whiz by.
Okay. Could the Enterprise actually come up to one to where it's just sitting right in front of it?
Yes, but obviously you have a good helmsman that makes sure you don't fly straight into a star, right?
Right. What would happen if... I mean, okay, so do the deflectors move the stars out of the way?
No. I think you'll drive around the star. So it's just that you wouldn't go in that direction. I mean, most of the space is empty, right?
Yeah.
So even if you were going through the star system, you... Maybe it would actually might be a cool effect every now and again that you, as you're warping, you actually get pretty close to a star, so that instead of it whizzing by it and being a little dot, it whizzes by and it's like half the view screen as you kind of, nearly hit it, but don't quite.
What would happen if you hit it?
Well, you remember in Generations where Dr. Soren blew up the Viridian Star, the Bozeman had to make a course correction because of the gravitational anomaly.
Oh, okay, so a star would be like our sun.
Right.
Yeah. Although, just be aware that the when a star is blown up, it will take the speed of light for the effect of the gravity being destroyed, if that's what you believe is happening, to propagate. So you probably wouldn't need to make a course correction for several thousand years.
Yeah,
because when you see the star in a long way away, not only do you see the star and the light as of that point, but you also feel the gravity as of that past as well.
Oh, fascinating! So
the idea is that gravity propagates at the speed of light.
All right. Well, as Dark Helmet would say, everybody got that? Good. Okay.
Although, hang on, by the way, just before we get get too excited, just be aware that there's a large amount of, we do not have a unified fields theory yet, so there's a lot of this is unknown. In particular, the idea of, gravity and theories of gravity and quantum mechanics all working together, which is not really there yet.
All right. And we did forget to mention that Captain Maxwell did hold a phaser to O'Brien for a while. But he puts it down. And then he walks away from it. So O'Brien could have grabbed it at any time. But that's just not the way O'Brien is. So obviously, he's holding a phaser on him, but there's still a high amount of trust between the two. So, yeah, I think Captain Maxwell was awesome. I think he was a very good, memorable person in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Okay, is there anything else we forgot?
I don't think so.
No. Doc, anything?
Not that I'm aware of, other than this is all great. I really like this. And I don't think it, there are a couple of unanswered questions as to whether or not the Cardassians are really being schemy here or not. Whether it's the Glynn going off and looking at the plans, or whether it's the ship supplying a science colony or whatever they were trying to do. And I think it's very good that these things aren't answered, and really it's the story isn't about the exact rights and wrongs of these particular actions, but more of the overarching governance framework. This episode really reminds me of dealing with my 10-year-old, which is that someone comes up to me and says, oh, he punched me. And I'm like, well, don't do it again. and then but he punts me first. Maxwell's come in from a kind of very much a bickering perspective, and I always see Picard as taking control as an adult. And yeah, I just had flashbacks to that when I was watching this earlier today.
Okay.
Anywho, whatever. Okay. All right, well then I guess it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. So, Sean, let's start with you as our guest. Explain why this doesn't deserve a 5. I bet you can't do it.
Why it doesn't deserve a 5?
Yeah, but you can't do it.
I can't do it because it's fantastic. Maxwell is a guest star, but he does great. It's like he's been on the Next Generation for the last 4 years. He fully inhabited his character, so that was awesome. We get to meet O'Brien more personally and find out more about him and all his backstory and his Cardassian war days and all that good stuff. And we get to meet the Cardassians, and even though they're not looking exactly like how they will look, their species is fully developed and fully formed, and they've got the sneakiness and the you never know exactly what they're planning or what their intentions are, and they're duplicitous and all that good stuff, and it's fantastic. So I have to give it a 5 out of 5.
5 out of 5. Okay. All right, and Doc, I don't know if we discussed last week about how did O'Brien and Keiko meet. That would have been interesting to get some backstory. Like, he was walking through the Arboretum one day, and he said, "Ooh, she's cute." Were they in 10-4 or
Data something? Introduced them.
Data did. Oh, yes.
Do you not know your Trek history, man?
That's right. That's right. We just talked about this last week, didn't we, James?
We did indeed.
Uh-huh.
Sure. We did indeed. All right.
Yeah, it was great having Colin on as well.
It was. It's really a hoot. And everything lined up just fine to get him on. There was no hiccups in the scheduling at all. You know, it's not like you guys had to sit there and wonder where the hell I was or anything.
Indeed. Anyway, let me go next here, because I don't think there's a huge amount I'm going to say here. This episode's wonderful. Sometimes I don't know whether or not it's just me or whether or not these episodes are considered to be great, kind of universally. This episode hasn't got a huge amount going on, not a big storyline or anything like that. It's just a wonderfully written character piece of O'Brien, Card, of the Maxwell character that you can completely identify with straight away, and it kind of keeps you drawn in throughout the episode. I love the Nebula class ship, as I mentioned. I can't see anything wrong with this episode at all. It's full 5 marks from me. 5 out of 5.
Okay, all right. Well, as I said, this is one of my all-time favorites, and definitely one that goes on any road trip. So on my way back from Las Vegas, if I do end up taking that 32-hour Greyhound bus, this will be one that I will have on video, even though I've just reviewed it and obviously just watched it. I will watch it again. There are some others that are also from this season as well that I do love to go through on any road trip. But up to this point, I'll only say Family, The Best of Both Worlds. I won't go through the upcoming, because obviously that would give away what I think about them. The Cardassians will end up being one of the best villains, only beat out by the Dominion as one of the most threatening villains, or not even threatening, maybe the Borg.
Not Voyager Borg, though.
No, not Voyager Borg. No. That was after Picard had his hands on Hugh. They were neutered quite a bit for Voyager. Which, really, it was interesting why we never saw the Borg on Deep Space Nine.
We did an Emissary.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Well, right, yeah.
But it doesn't really count.
Doesn't count.
And they were too far away on the opposite edge of space. So.
Yeah, Wolf 359, which Doc did teach me that is an actual real star system. Thank you.
It is, yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought it was something made up. But anyway, really, the Cardassians are an awesome villain, especially Gul Dukat later on, so we're not going to see the end of Marco Lamo anytime soon. So Upper Pylon 2 is very lucky that they get to watch him and Kai win. I mean, those are some of the best villains on Deep Space Nine. Probably the two best villain besides the Dominion, the female changeling.
Maybe Brunt.
Brunt. Brunt. S-C-A. And so anyway.
You know what? I think Jeffrey Combs should be on Star Trek Discovery.
Yes.
I'm just going to put that out here right now.
Doc, is he going to be available next week?
He is, yes.
I wonder if... okay, when I go to a Star Trek convention, I've went to Starbase Indy and I've went to Trekfest. Those are really the only... Well, then we went to Dragon Con. In Starbase Indy, it's so informal and so small that the actors sit at a table in the hallway where people could go up and actually talk to them, get their autographs and pictures and stuff. But
get your recording device so you can say, "Hey, this is Walter Koenig, and you're listening to the Battlebridge Podcast."
Oh, he'll never do that, by the way.
Oh, some of them, anybody, somebody.
But that's what I'm getting at. I mean, are they that available that we could actually go up and walk up and talk to them?
No.
I wouldn't think so either.
You will not be within. You won't be within 50 feet of any of these actors, unless you pay to go and get something signed. At which point you will have a 5 or 6 second interaction with them.
True,
I would imagine.
Right. Or at Starbase Indy, I was actually able to talk to Garrett Wong for quite a long time. It was quite fun, actually.
But when I say these actors, I'm not including Garrett Wong. I'm sure his line will be completely empty, and he'll basically be open for any conversations he can
get. That poor Gary Wang, I tell you.
Wong. You got it, Wong. See, you already got it, Wong.
No, it's Gary Wang.
It's Wong. He always said if you say Wang, you would get it Wong.
I know.
Well, I think part of it is maybe his Janeway impersonation's getting kind of old. But anyway. Let's see where I was. The story, I think, is very wonderfully done. It is about revenge, and he was trying to blow the lid off the Cardassian subterfuge, if that's the right word. All in all, it's a great acting. I'll give this a 3, I'd say.
At least a three.
And then you get one more for the minstrel boy, because that was an awesome, awesome scene. And Picard's warning to Golmaset gives it another boost. So I guess in the end, it comes out to a 5.
Good job.
As if I was going to give this a 3. Can you imagine the jaws that dropped there for a second when I said give it a 3? Kieran McDuff is probably going, "What the hell?" All right, Sean, let me find you in the future. I don't know where you are. I don't have you anything on this season coming up.
That can't be true.
It can't.
I'm sure I gave you a whole list of episodes I wanted to be on our first talk.
Oh, well, we try to limit to 2 or 3. But okay. No, I only have you for 2 this season.
This season, yes. What about season 5?
Well, you know, season 5 comes out around the end of season 4 type of stuff.
All right.
A matter of time. No, Darmok. Something like that.
At Tanagra.
But, yep, nope, we'll get to season 5 later.
All right.
What else have we got to do? Anything?
Just say who we are and what we stand for and where we're from, I guess.
Oh, that's right. You know, we don't really do that, do we? No, we don't. We don't say, okay, I'm Lou from Nebraska. He's Sean from Timmins, Ontario, and that's James from London. So there you go, guys. We're good.
From the gates of hell comes the ultimate evil.
Who are you?
The devil.
A demonic power terrorizes a peaceful planet.
These people are all convinced that their world is coming to an end.
And a deadly game of seduction could steal Picard's soul.
I can do anything for you, Captain.
Your life is in danger here.
Enterprise, come in.
Your ship is gone, Captain.
Duel with the Devil on Star Trek The Next Generation.
So why don't you join us next week as we discuss episode 13, The Devil's Due. Another excellent show. And this time we're going to have Cena on. So for everyone in Omaha, Nebraska, take care, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
And good night.